So we know for sure God like it. Because it's all about characters. Then we know it's just.
Later, we learn that if he's expecting guests, and a lot of guests, he can bring a lot of food to prepare the...
We're talking about what he doesn't need it to eat. He wants to bring it in more than for what he needs. He just needs... Well, we already started off that. We're not talking about a situation where he needs it, let's say, in a chamoyet, where he needs it for the
doesn't
use of the...
It.
He doesn't need it. The only reason he's bringing it in is simply because he's afraid it's going to be stolen. Then he can bring it in. If he has it outside and he doesn't need it, we don't want him engaging in the activity of just bringing it into the house just because.
Machnis Odom... And the weather's going to... There's rain that's announced.
So again, if it's we're afraid of a loss, he can bring it in. That's the point. The point of all of this is that if it's afraid it's going to be stolen, but if he has oranges and it's going to rain, the rain isn't going to bother him.
If he has grain,
and or he has something that we'll learn later in the Gemara, we can't. We got to get to the mission. Machnis Odom Beis. We're at the bottom of the Beis Amud Beis. The Mishnah where we left off yesterday, the towards the bottom of Yudbeis Amud Beis. Machnis Odom Beis Meaganot. Somebody brings in fruit. A person is permitted to bring in fruit to Meaganot because he's afraid of the theft that will occur if he leaves it outside. Is it possible for the theft? I'm certain that it'll be stolen, but. Maybe some. You can pull out the flax from the pot in which it is soaking. In order to turn flax into linen threads, you have to, fibers, you have to let it soak. And but if you let it soak too long, it gets spoiled. So if the person put it in before Yom Tov, and he was sitting there, and now he sees that it is ready, he can take it out of the pot, even though it's a labor. And even though he's not going to be turning these into threads that he's going to turn into a material on Chol HaMoed, because obviously at Chol HaMoed, you're not allowed to sew on Chol HaMoed. So he's not going to be using these fabrics, so it's Shloi L'Tzei L'Chamoed. Nevertheless, because of the hefty, because of the loss that will be involved, we are going to permit him to take it out. So this mission is referring to matters that, for which there will be a loss if he doesn't engage in this activity. So he can take out the pishtan. We learned this last mission also about Avel, the same thing. Shloi L'Tzei L'Chamoed, so it shouldn't be lost. Ubilvad. So the provisio is Shloi Chavin es Malachti v'moyed. So long as he didn't set this all up such that he knew from the outset that guess what's going to happen? I'm going to put this stuff into the pot. It's going to get ready. And you know what? I'm not going to take it. It takes 5 days. And 5 days will be Chol HaMoed. And Chol HaMoed, I'm not going to be working. So this, I'll reserve this work for Chol HaMoed and I'll take it out. Or I'll put pile up all the fruits into the courtyard. I'll leave it there, and I know that at some time, somebody's taking off the lock on the door, then I'll bring it into the house. If you know already from before Chol HaMoed, if you know from before Yom Tov that this is going to occur, and you leave it with the intent so that you'll have some work to do on Chol HaMoed, then it is prohibited. And in fact, someone who engages in such activity loses the benefit of the activity and he gets a knas. So what we're going to learn now, so long as he doesn't intend to engage in the practice on Chol HaMoed. The chulon in kivna malachim b'moed, what happens if he set it up, he scheduled it such that he knew that this was going to occur on Chol HaMoed, then he has to take the loss and he can't engage in this loss-preventing activity. The Gemara says, Tana, we learned, this that we said, that once it's permitted to bring in items that he's afraid that are going to be stolen, he's allowed to bring them to his house on Chol HaMoed. So the provisio is Ovachich Nisan Bitzina, on condition that he brings it in quietly, without public notice. The Techbeth into his house. Now, we're going to see a story where it seemingly did not occur, that he didn't follow this rule. Rav Yosef Havalei Kishurim, Rav Yosef had these large beams. He had big, large, heavy beams that, you know, I guess they can build a house with. Maybe he was reconstructing his house. Anyway, he got delivery of Kishurim, he got these beams. Eilina B'Yamami, he brought them into his house during the day. Omerli Abaye said to him, to Rav Yosef, Atanya, we learned the Bovachiach Nisim Bitzina, that this, that the Mishnah said, that you're allowed to bring in items that you're afraid are going to get lost or going to get ruined, and here, this, in this case, he was afraid that they were going to get ruined, so he wanted to bring them into his house, and we learned in the Braisa that the Braisa puts a condition on it that it has to be brought in while quietly in a manner that's not publicly noticeable. And here you just brought it in broad daylight. In the case of heavy beams, if you want to move construction material unobtrusively, do it during the day. Because if you start moving beams during the night, so it makes a whole ruckus. The whole town starts seeing what's going on. Here in the Belayla, since it's at night, folk out there, you say that you need extra workers. And you need people to hold torches. Hapshenilfes makes everybody sees that there's, he's been construction in the south, in the middle of Chol HaMoed, what's going on?
Do it, Bettina,
the way to do it unobtrusively is to do it in broad daylight. Sometimes the easiest way to break into a house is to pull up a ladder and climb into the window without trying to hide it from anyone. Because then they think that what? You're a worker. Or you're the owner of the house. Because no one would have the chutzpah to do that. But that's precisely the way to do it. I'm not giving ideas how to do it. V'shoyle pishtonim yinei mishra. And you can pull out, you can remove the flax from the pot in which it's soaking. So Rav Yirmiyah asked from Rabbi Zeir, "Kivim alachdim amoyidim me. What happens if somebody put this stuff or any other malacha that he intended to do that should require his activity during Chol HaMoed, otherwise it would sustain a loss? Or somebody just started engaging in activity that was prohibited on Chol HaMoed. Omeis, and he died.
On the Moed?
He died.
On the Moed, not
yeah, no, he died after in a Chol HaMoed, yeah. Or at any time before he was able to finish the Iktar. So let's say he put fish songs, wax into a pot, saying, go, it'll be ready on Chol HaMoed. Then he died. And it comes Chol HaMoed, and people say, oh, and I realize there's fish songs in there. Mahushi comes to one of Achrav. What is the rule about giving a knas to his children? Should we penalize the children,
okay,
those who are inheriting, or not. Now, on one hand, it's not their fault.
No.
On the other hand, they're inheriting the position of their father, but their father engaged in wrongful activity, and the father wouldn't be permitted to take it out, and so they're inheriting, in a sense, shouldn't be entitled to inherit any greater position than the father.
If he had been alive.
If the father was alive, he wouldn't be allowed to remove it.
Correct.
So when he
won't.
So how can he be moidish? How can he give over? How can he give to inherit something that he didn't have? He didn't have the right to remove this fish son from the pot on Cholamoid. He didn't have the right to do it. So how can he give over by dying the right to his children to remove it from the pot? So do we say that the knas is complete? And once it's so completed, we say that he no longer has the right to do something completely, and so now he can't even give it over to his children the right to remove it. Or do we say no, it's a knas, and a knas is a penalty, and so it applies to the person who's penalized, and to the person who didn't engage in wrongful activity shouldn't be penalized.
Does it apply to the person, or does it apply to the...
That's precisely, that's in a sense the question, and we're going to modify it in a minute. But that's one way of putting it. Now, if he's going to try to come with an answer by saying, somebody, you had a kohen and he got a bechor. The bechor has to be brought as a karbon, but if it has a mum in it, and so it can't be brought as a karbon, then he could shecht it and he could eat it. So he engaged in wrongful activity, and he went and he took out a knife and he cut the ear of the animal, so then now it would have a mum. So tzaram oizen bechor. The concept of Bnei Achrav, so we give a knas to his son after, and you shouldn't be sitting there answering. The answer there, you can't bring the proof because it's the Eidaisa. In other words, when it comes to a violation of a prohibition of the Torah law, then we're going to say that the knas is a complete knas. It's a penalty that permeates through and through, and so once it becomes author, it's attached, and it can never become mutter again. And so the person who dies didn't have the ownership of the
full
the ownership ability, the right in the bundle of rights of ownership. He didn't have the right to eat this animal, and since he didn't have the right to eat this animal, he couldn't give it over to his inheritors. But that's when it's a deraisa. So we don't have a proof in our case where it is an iser derabbanan. Now we have to stop for a moment because we had again at the beginning of the very first day that we started this masechta, we said this machlokes between Rashi and Tosfos. This keeps coming up again and again. Rashi says that the iser of doing malacha chalamoid is deraisa, and here it would seem like that Tosfos is correct that it is derabbanan. We said the knas is not from the Torah. The Torah didn't give the knas. The iser is the iser day, right? So here you engage.
But who made the knas? The Torah?
The Chachamim made the knas by the Bechor as well. The Bechor, the father, engaged in wrongful activity that violated a Torah prohibition, and the Chachamim put on a knas.
Right.
So the
prohibition is midiraisa, but not the knas.
But not the knas. Right. But according to Rashi, what kind of answer is that to say that this is not a proof? This is a proof because Cholamoid is also engaging in, according to Rashi, engaging in malacha on Cholamoid is a biblical prohibition.
Yes,
so then the knas should permeate. And so the father should not be able to give over the right to his child to be able to remove his son from the
If that's what's the case, the Torah should have mentioned it.
The Torah doesn't mention any knas.
That's the point.
No, that's not the point. We're making a parallel. Look, in the case of the Bechor, the Torah made a prohibition, you're not allowed to make a mum in the Bechor. Somebody who does,
The Torah doesn't say you can't shecht it and eat it. Torah doesn't allow you to put a mum in the bechar, but if you do, as far as the Torah is concerned, you can shecht it and eat it now. The Chachamim say you're not allowed to. So the Chachamim say if you engage in a biblical prohibition, you get a knas, and that knas permeates through and through, and so if the person dies, his children can't shecht it and eat it. Same thing, same parallel. If you hold the Chol HaMoed, it is a deraisa, and you engage in a malacha on Chol HaMoed, mechavamat, it's malachim HaMoed, you should get the knas, and the knas should be permeate through and through, and so the child should not be able to remove the flax from the pot. So we answer that even according to Rashi, who says that it's a deraisa, the Torah doesn't allow you to do, according to Rashi, a malacha on Chol HaMoed. But the Torah doesn't say that you're not allowed to be mechavim malachim malachim amoyed. That is that in a case where, from Torah perspective, from the absolute biblical perspective, if somebody took flax and he put it into his pot before Chol HaMoed and before Yom Tov and left it there, and now it has to be removed on Chol HaMoed, as far as the Torah is concerned, you can remove it from the pot. It's only the Chachamim who now say that you're not allowed to remove it from the pot. So now the knas is on a rabbinical prohibition. So the Chachamim say, in such a case, perhaps you're allowed to remove it from the pot. So now we go back to the Gemara. So now we have no answer. We only know we have a proof that when somebody engages in wrongful activity on a biblical level, then the knas permeates. But where is it on a rabbinical level? It doesn't permeate.
So the Bechor isn't with the knas regarding the Bechor, knas itself is...
No, the knas is midrabbana. Right. And always knas is going to be midrabbana.
But aren't they both on the level of
midrabbana? No, but what was the prohibition? The prohibition was the prohibited activity on a biblical level, or was the... or the prohibited activity on a rabbinical level, not the knas. The bechar to inflict a mum in a bechar is a biblical prohibition. Once you've done it, from the Torah perspective, if you've done it, you violated it. You violated the Torah prohibition. Now, does the Torah say that if you engage in that activity, you cannot slaughter the animal and eat it? No. The Torah then says, you've engaged in a prohibited activity, and now you can slaughter it and eat it. Then you'll suffer the other penalty of malchus, whatever it is that you'll suffer. But there's no penalty from the Torah that says that you can't slaughter and eat it. The sages say you can't slaughter it and eat it. And that's a knas. And not only can't you slaughter and eat it, if you die, your children can't either. So now it comes to the pot. The pot, we say, it's true that you're not allowed to put tishtun. You can't take flax on Chol HaMoed and put it into a pot to let it soak on Chol HaMoed. And that would be, according to Rashi, on a biblical level, that once the Torah gave it up to the sages, and the sages said that it's prohibited because of a biblical prohibition. But what the Torah didn't say and what the Chachamim didn't create as a biblical prohibition is to put the flax into the pot before Yom Tov for it to be ready on Chol HaMoed. If you do that, then according to everyone, both Rashi and Tosafos, you've only engaged in a rabbinical prohibition. And so now the question is, since you've only engaged in a rabbinical prohibition, it's understandable that when someone engages in a biblical prohibition, that the knas, the penalty, should be a greater penalty, and when he engages in a rabbinical prohibition, the penalty should be less so. Sometimes, actually, when it comes to Shabbos, we say actually the reverse sometimes, that we say that in order to be marked, some people are more ready to listen to a Torah prohibition, and so the penalty could be less, and rabbinical prohibition, they're more likely to engage in, so the penalty can be more. But in each situation, it goes one way or the other. And when it comes to Chol HaMoed, we're not certain, and so we ask, perhaps, just because it's a rabbinical prohibition, perhaps it may be that we can be lenient and the child would be permitted to remove it from the pot if the father dies. So now the Gemara says, and if you're going to try to bring a proof from this halacha, that one way or the other, let's see.
Somebody sells his servant, who was a non-Jewish servant, to a non-Jew who mates and he dies, comes to Bnei Akra. So we give a knas to his son afterwards to redeem from the estate, from the money that's in the estate, he has to go and redeem this slave. Now what's happening here is as follows. A non-Jewish slave has mitzvahs like a woman has. He has to engage in all the mitzvahs. He doesn't have to put on stone. Anything that mitzvahs is shemayim krama, he doesn't have to do. He has to fulfill all mitzvahs. What does that say? All mitzvahs that shemayim mind grama, he has to fulfill. So now, if you take this non-Jewish slave and you sell him to a non-Jew, the non-Jew is not going to give him off on Shabbos. He's not going to give him off on Yom Kippur. He's not going to allow him to keep kosher, etc. He's going to give him whatever food is on the table and say, listen, you want to eat, you're going to have to eat this, and it's going to be non-kosher food. So the slave is going to have to engage in non-kosher food. Now what happens is, from a halachic perspective, a Jew who owns a non-Jewish slave has a right to the person. He owns the person. Whereas a non-Jew who owns a non-Jewish slave only owns the Maisa Yada, his work output. So when he sells the slave, he still owns the slave because he can only sell to the non-Jew the Maisa Yada of the slave. And so he still retains an ownership interest in this slave. And so we say that since he still owns he has an ownership interest, this person still mechuyav in mitzvah. He still has to keep all these mitzvahs. And every day that he's sitting by the non-Jew as a slave, he's causing this non-Jewish slave to violate the Torah laws. And so we have a knas that he has to go and he has to pay 10 times, or according to some opinions, 100 times the value of what he sold it for in order to redeem this slave. And so now, what happens if the person who sold the slave died, and they left over an estate, so the inheritors have to take from the estate, the same like the person who died would have to do, take his money and his possessions to go to redeem the slave.
So do you know when he goes free or he goes back to
the... And then there's also a knas that he goes free. But for our point is that the child has to go and redeem the slave. This whole prohibition is from the Chacham. It says, Mishum d'chol yeimach ki alei mitzvah. There, it may be that the reason why he has to redeem him is to go and pay the redemption. Even the child has to go and pay it. It's because every day that goes by, this slave, who is mechuyav in mitzvah, is not being mekayem the mitzvah. And so there's a special necessity, and so we say that you have to take from the estate and redeem
the mitzvah. The mitzvah of every community, like a woman, not like a they're all allowed.
Yeah, they're mechuyav all the law.
Yeah, in other words, what are you saying that he's not kind of mitzvah? In other words, would you say that force him to work on Shabbos? Or?
I mean, presumably he's going to force him to work on Shabbos.
It's not like he's putting on tefillin already.
No. But he's going to have to work on Shabbos.
Well, so that was the question on our Gemara.
No,
the question. You see that they have...
It's not a question. We're asking a question. We tried to bring a proof.
So we cannot derive.
We wanted to bring a proof that you when you give a knas to a father and the father dies, the son inherits the knas. Right. So we say no. There is different. Why? Because there is the slave has to be redeemed. So we're just gonna put it on the child to take money from the estate. And go and redeem.
Was this part of the question on And the Shalei Pishtana or...
The Shalei Pishtana or any of the activities that we said about Chalamoyed, in Kivin, Malachis, Malachis, and Moyed, so you may do. That anybody who says, sets up something that will have to be done on Chalamoyed, otherwise there will be a loss, if he set it up that way, that it should come out on Chalamoyed, knowing that it was going to come out on Chalamoyed, then he sustained the loss.
So the originally the Gemara brought from a question from the court that we answered, that doesn't apply. Does that fall away? Now we're asking regarding...
Right, now we're trying to bring a proof from the case of the Eved. It's said by the Eved that you have to go and redeem him. And even the child has to redeem him. So,
the knack
that the child has to go and redeem them. So the child didn't do anything wrong, and yet we say that the child has to redeem him. So we should say the same thing by Chalamoyed that the child sustains the loss. He inherits the knack. So it's a knack. So there's a knack. There's a knack. So you inherit the knack. So the Gemara says no. Over there, by the slave, by the servant, there's a special reason why he has to do it, because otherwise there's a problem. This slave every day is going to have, every day that goes by, he's doing more and more of it. So the Gemara says, how am I? What's the reason? Gavra kanis rabbanan, as you put it before, is it the person who is getting the knack? Well, the lesson, the person isn't here. Or is it the minor kosher abundant? Or is it that it placed the knack on the object? And the object is a knack object, and so it can no longer be of benefit to anyone. Obviously, this object is here.
Government meaning the son. Or...
No. Did we give a knack to the person, and the person died, and so the person is not here? In the case of Mechav HaMachis Malach HaMamoy, the person is no longer here, right? He's sick. So there's no one who engaged in wrong activity at this moment, right? Yeah. So why bother with the knas? Who are you giving the knas to? No, not to anyone who engaged in any wrongful activity. So we should take off the knas. Or, on the other hand, do we say that a knas permeates the object itself, and so once it becomes a prohibited object, it doesn't matter who owns it, it's prohibited, a prohibited object. And so the fact that the son now owns it and he didn't engage in wrongful activity is irrelevant. So that's the question. Let's back to the question. Return to the question. On my way, so now we're going to try to resolve it from the following. We learned in Yisrael, we learned in a Mishnah in Shviyas, that Saltesh and Iskatsa, if you had a field that had thorns in it, and on Shviyas, it was on Shemitah, and he went and he removed the thorns. Now, we learned earlier that on Shemitah, that's a prohibited activity. Removing thorns from a field on Shemitah is prohibited. So, nevertheless, we say Tizara l'mitzvah Shviyas, that you can still go and sow and plant the field immediately after Shemitah. There is no knas. Why? Because taking out the thorns is not a biblical prohibition. And even on a rabbinical level, it's not one of the most serious rabbinical violations. It doesn't even resemble anything of planting. What you're doing is removing thorns. You're just removing thorns, not removing weeds. You're just removing thorns that are sitting on top of the ground. They're not detached. You're removing the thorns. You're removing twigs. You're just removing debris from the field. So the Chacham didn't give any knas whatsoever, and in that situation, you engaged in a prohibited activity, but there's no knas for it.
And Shemitah is
deraisa. Shemitah is deraisa, but the removing of the thorns would only be prohibited midrabbanan. And even on a derabbanan level, on the scale of rabbinical prohibitions, this is on the lesser side. This is not one of the more serious. Yitayva oin the daida. What happens if he took animals and he brought them into the field to fertilize the field, or he put a corral around the field, around the animals, so the animals can breathe, and so then they would, in that sense, go around and fertilize the field. So basically, he engaged in activities to cause fertilization of the field. Now, that's a more serious rabbinical prohibition. It's not a biblical prohibition on Shemitah, but it is a rabbinical prohibition, and on the scheme of things, it's on the more serious side. So, when you saw the Meitzei Shiyas, you're not allowed to plant Meitzei Shiyas. You got to wait a period of time before you do this. Amar Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina, and Rabbi Yosi Bar Chanina says, Naktina, we rule that Heitiva Umneis, that if you engage in this activity of bringing animals into the field to fertilize it, and then he dies, B'nei Zeda, his son, is allowed to, who inherits the field, is allowed to sow the field. Alma, what do we see from this? Lididei comes to Rabbanan when it's a rabbinical prohibition and there is a knas, then it's only the person himself who receives the knas. Livreili comes to Rabbanan, but the Chachamim did not put a knas on the child.
So
we see that when it comes to Rabbanan, this is the Rabbanan, the knas is only on the gavra, it's only on the person, and not on the chefet, not on the mummy, not on the object. Based on this case, we have a proof. Bahachanami, so here too, Rabbintei, Kanser Rabbanan, we can derive from this that the person, only the person himself engaged in the wrongful activity of being Mechavamat Melachbe B'moyed gets the knas, Librei, the Kanser Rabbanan, but if he dies, his child can remove it on Chalamoid from the pot or whatever other thing, activity that he did that would have to be performed, that caused that the activity would have to be performed on Chalamoid, the child can perform.
And he doesn't have to pay the knas.
There's no knas. There's no knas. The knas was that he couldn't remove it from the pot.
Okay.
And so he would have sustained the loss of the flax. So we say, you know, he can remove the flax from the pot. Or if he scheduled delivery of these beans on Chalamoid, so they would get stolen, and they would be stolen. But if the father dies after he placed the order, and the child doesn't know about it, gets a delivery of Chalamoid, he says, my father ordered this, and I see you was ordered scheduled delivery for Chalamoid, he's allowed to bring it into the house. Amar Abaya, Abaya says, Nakhino, we received the Kabbalah from our Chachamim, that he is an Adesa, Umeis, that what happens if somebody went and he made somebody else's food Chalamoid? So probably here we're talking about a truma, because that's a real serious prohibition. We're talking about a case, somebody who was oichel chumim betara. There were people who generally ate only tahar foods. They, even though they were a Yisrael, they ate, not truma. They're chulin, they only ate if it was tahar, the same way as if they kept the same stringencies for their food as if there would be truma. So now, this guy, he was this, you know, ultra-Orthodox fella, he had his food. Comes this other guy, and he's and he touches the guy's food. So there were people who were oichel chulin betara obligation. So they were. So he caught them. Now he can't. Now this person who was oichel chulin betara. So now this person was oichel. One second. This person was oichel chulin betara. He can no longer eat it.
Can he not longer? I mean, he made a neder, or he was just...
He was the kabbal. There's rules of when the person is faulted. It wasn't just... When I say ultra-Orthodox, I didn't really mean ultra-Orthodox. The point of ultra-Orthodox was the point is that there were certain things that that in order to be called a chaver, and a chaver, in order to be, there was a certain group, and they were considered trustworthy people for a whole host of things. And in order to join that elite group, they had to be mekabel to be oichel to chulin betara. And now, this guy is about to sit down to eat his supper, and this guy comes and touches it, and now, and he's done. So he has to pay this guy for the loss. Now he has to go and he has to sell it, or sometimes he can't even sell it. What do I do with it? So he has to replace, he has to pay him for the thing. So what happens if what happens if this guy comes? So Reuven is sitting down, about to eat his supper. The Shimon guy comes over, touches his food. Now he can't eat it. So Shimon asks. So there's a rule that Shimon is supposed to pay Reuven for the food. So I'm going to buy anything that I said to Mason. So and he's always, so now the fact that Shimon has to pay Reuven for the food is not a halacha. It's a knas. It's a knas. But so the what comes to Benoyah? Yeah, the Chachamim said you have to pay as a knas. Don't play games with these people. They're just and touch it. So what comes to Benoyah? But they didn't give the knas to the child who inherits the father. He doesn't have to pay the knas from the estate. My time up. What's the reason why we say that he doesn't have to? Shehezik sheiniker loishmei hezik, because it's a hezik that's not observable. If I take this, if I take an orange and I make it tummy, I make another orange and it's not tummy, and I ask you which one is the tummy one, you couldn't tell. Since it's not niker, it's not observable to the eye. It's only a status and not something that you can see. It's not, from a halakha perspective, it's not considered a hezek at all. It's a loss, you sustain the loss. That's not a halakha. Then there's the chachamim that say that you have to. So we say that unobservable loss is something that has to be paid. It's a knas, and only has to be paid by the person who engaged in the wrongful activity. But if he dies, we don't give the knas to the child. So the day comes to Rabban, and the very day comes to Rabban. It's also a support, and it's just another application. We already have from a Mishnah. We already have our.
There's nothing more rejected. Like, no, it's not because of that.
We have the case of the father should be scoffed. The case of the
no,
case.
No, but I mean, from here it looks like the Gavra, that the person, the son.
Right, the thought doesn't get it, and that's the point.
So the Gemara rejects that.
The Gemara didn't reject that. No, there, Hezek Re'ir Loshmei Hezek is that there the son doesn't get the knas. We didn't give the knas on the child. Why we needed that? Why we couldn't just say it goes on the Gavra in this case? I'm not certain. I don't know, but the Gemara is not rejecting. The Gemara is just bringing another application. The Gemara already established the rule elsewhere, and it's not an ethic. That's the point. No. What he's saying is once we've already established that it goes on the Gavra, and we know by a Knas Rabbanan from the when
the Nezek goes on a Gavra, but here the Gemara precisely mentioned it's not an Nezek. It doesn't reach the degree of a Nezek.
Right. So since it doesn't reach the degree of Nezek, then it should go on the trial regardless of the
of who it's on.
You know what? Let me suggest something. We don't have any more questions. We never get to the stage.
Fine. We're just gonna finish off. I think that the point of what the Gemara is saying is a bit circular, but the point I think of what this Gemara is just saying is the fact to establish that the person has to pay as a knas. Why doesn't he have to pay mitzvah din? Why is it that the person shouldn't have to pay? Because it's a hezek she'enei niker. That's what created. So the Gemara is not saying here a second level of because it's a hezek she'enei niker. Therefore, it doesn't go to the child. That type of knas doesn't go to the child. I think what the Gemara is just explaining is what's the reason why it's not mideraisa that the person has to pay is because the person didn't create a hezek niker. Because it's not a hezek niker, it's only darabanan, and therefore it's only a knas. And since we already have established that something that's not payable mideraisa, it's only mideraabanan as a knas, then it goes on the gavra and not on the chas. And that's why the child doesn't have to pay. I think that's the explanation. Ein loitin batim avodim ubehema elo lecherech. One is not permitted to buy a house, a slave, or an animal unless he needs it for the money. So he needs a house. He's homeless. He got evicted. He needs a house. He can buy a house on Kalamoy. He doesn't have any help. He can buy a slave on Kalamoy. He doesn't have an animal. The shack. Buy it on Kalamoy or for the last day of Yom Tov. Or let's say the guy has he has a house, he has a servant, he has a car, he has a man. But the seller is in desperate need. He's in dire need. He doesn't have enough money to make Yom Tov. Or he's not in dire need. He has enough. He has matzah. He has a box of striped matzah in his house. He doesn't have he doesn't have a roast. He doesn't have fish. He doesn't have wine. But he could go and he could sell a house. He could go and sell a slave. He can go and sell an animal. And the purchaser, who doesn't need the house, the slave, or the animal, is allowed to buy it to alleviate the seller's need. Yes. Now here's this Mishnah is unclear. Are we talking about Dafka, a bias, an Eved or Behema, which has a huge pull? It's very public. Somebody buying the house, everyone's talking about it. Did you hear me? He bought the house, what he paid for it. I can't believe he got it so cheap. I can't believe he paid so much money. Or, I don't want him as a neighbor. Everyone talks about how the house is going to have a big call. Avodim, slaves, everyone's talking about it. The Hema is like the equivalent of today a car. You bought a Jaguar, that guy, he owes me $50, and he buys a Jaguar, everyone's talking about it. So, are we only talking about things that are big with our hefty like that? Or are we talking about any small thing you can buy or sell, and his mission is talking about that? And so there's a dispute among the Pesachim about what's going on here. And we'll try to decipher it as we're going along the line. Farmine Rabba Mirab Nachman. Rabba asked from the Ramah. Charpa Ulo, She'enli Ma, She'yechol Ma. What is the rule about engaging somebody to do work for you on Chol HaMoed, where the person has no money to make Yom Tov? So you have a worker, Shimon knocks on your door and says, listen, you need any job? I'm a handyman. Can I do some handiwork for you? And Reuven says, Chol HaMoed, Shimon, I got no money. I can't make Yom Tov unless I go to work. Is Reuven now allowed to engage Shimon to do work for him on Chol HaMoed that he himself has no need for on Chol HaMoed, to engage in Malacha for which Reuven doesn't need it for Chol HaMoed. But this is just to alleviate Shimon's dire financial strait. Now here, why is this different from the Mishnah? Why would we assume that this would be different? And we explained this already earlier, that Rashi makes a big difference between work, and prakmatia, business. Prakmatia is not a gift of the Raisa. Engage, somebody opens this shop on Shabbos, does not engage in a Torah prohibition. The Chachamim said, you're not allowed to do it because inevitably you're going to come to right. But just the buying and selling and all of that, there's no Torah prohibition. You can buy yourself according to the Torah. The problem is, the Chacham says, you always going to end up doing calculations, you're going to end up right. It's inevitable. So you're not going to open your shop. But the actual act of buying and selling is not a malacha. And so Rashi said, possibly, one way of reading Rashi is that even when there's a loss of profit, you can engage in a transaction. You're going to lose money. Not you're going to lose the profit of selling it on Yom Tov, on Chol HaMoed. If you sell it after Yom Tov, you'll be able to sell it for less. Though in either case, when you sustain a loss, in each case, you'll make back the principal and maybe even gain a profit. If you gain a greater profit on Chol HaMoed, you can engage in that sale on Chol HaMoed according to one understanding of Rashi. Whereas work, to do malacha, it has to be a loss of principle before we can consider it to be a davar ha'avod. In order to use the heter of davar ha'avod, there has to be a loss of principle. So we see anyway a difference between prakmatia and malacha. So the Mishnah was talking about prakmatia, was talking about business, buying and selling animals. Now we're talking about Shimon coming and saying, I want to engage in labor for you on your behalf.
And we have a question regarding
Shabbos, you're saying part of my time.
We're not talking about Shabbos now.
I understand, but you mentioned that point, so I have a question.
We'll do it after.
Very briefly, yes. You said that Parmata is not a melach on Shabbos.
Yes.
But there's an obligation, and I'm asking if doing business is not violating the obligation to keep Shabbos Kodesh.
There's a melacha derabbanan. There's the derabbanan to engage in Parmata. Basic reasons. The main reason being you're going to end up coming to right. The second thing is that the Yemen is at the time of rest. That's what the Chachamim say. It's the Isidore Abon. So the engaging in Pragmatia and Cholomoy would not be engaging in an Isidore right to begin with. That's why we have more lenient rules when it comes to Pragmatia than when it comes to labor. And here in the Mishnah, as I mentioned earlier, you don't have to be in dire straits. If you have matzah to eat, but you don't have fish, and you don't have kugel, and you don't have roast, you can buy and sell in order to get money so that you can buy all the things that you want, not absolute necessity, but to make a yomtov. You can engage in that activity, but so long as you're going to be using it for yomtov purposes. Twice can say that when we're going to say here that it will be permitted to engage in the labor, that's only to give him the beer necessities, not to buy a roast, to buy just basic necessities, a loaf of bread, a challah, wine, and that.
There's something called a time coin that a person has 200 or two.
Yeah, then he becomes not an honor. But we're not talking about this, we're talking about the money that he needs for Yomtov itself. So he comes and he says, I want to engage you in. I want you to hire me to do some work for you. And you don't need a civil letter for money. So you can't hire him if he already has basic necessities in his house. He says, listen, I have absolutely nothing. I got nothing in now. You can hire him. So I'm going to lay, he said, to him, we learned, we're going to try to bring a proof from our Mishnah that the Mishnah said, or what's the reason why you can buy and sell and engage in this activity? It's because the meicha has nothing to eat. The meicha doesn't have what to eat. So the Gemara says, "Latsuyamai." What does that come to say? I would imagine, even without those words, that we're going to say that when it is that you're allowed to buy and sell, that's when the person, somebody, doesn't have what to eat. So why do I need these extra words? Tell us specifically that in any case where the person needs something to eat, then it's permitted. So, when it comes to include the case of not just buying and selling, but also of labor, over there, we need to say that either the buyer needs it for himself, or he's allowed to engage in the activity because the seller needs it. But we don't have any extra work to tell us that in the case of labor, that you can engage in this activity if the laborer has something to eat. But we're going to bring a proof on the next one. The Eisvei, and this word Eisvei, a lot of Mepharshim take out and just say Pashma. That's not a question. Pashma. Abaya, and in fact, it's going to be a proof. Abaya said, in case of Shlachayev, B'moyev. You can't write a Shlachayev on Cholomoyev. Reuven wants to lend money to Shimon, and generally the rule is that you shouldn't lend money without a shtar chayv because it's going to create a problem. The best thing is to write a shtar. But in any matter, but a cholmei, you're not allowed to write. So even though generally there's a requirement to write it down, in this case he wouldn't be writing it down unless Reuven doesn't actually trust Shimon. He's giving him that law, not trusting him. So he wants him to write it down. The man never made it. He doesn't believe it. Or he doesn't have what he needs. Now, we're not saying who doesn't have what he needs. But, Areze Yichseis. So then, the Sefer could write it down.
Even though he doesn't trust him?
No. What happens if he does trust him? He says, if he doesn't trust him, then he can write it down. Or if he doesn't have what he needs. Now, presumably, he can't be talking about the Leiva doesn't have what to eat, because that's why Leiva's borrowing money. So who is it talking about? Sheinli ma yoichel. If he trusts him, so why is he writing it? On the one hand, because Reuven If Reuben trusts Shimon, let's make the case. If Reuben trusts Shimon,
doesn't need a star.
Then he doesn't need the star.
But he doesn't trust him.
Let's take it slow. Reuben trusts Shimon, so he gives him the money. Yes. Reuben doesn't trust Shimon, and he writes it down. That's what the first part of the Mishnah said. So what's the second part of the Mishnah? She'en le'mayezo. What if he doesn't have what to eat? Who doesn't have what to eat? If it's the loiva, so does he trust him? So let him give it. So then why do I mean? Then it doesn't matter whether he has what to eat or he doesn't have what to eat. You don't write it down, right? He trusts him. If he doesn't trust him, then it doesn't matter whether he has what to eat or he doesn't have what to eat. You're going to write it down. So what is she'en le'mayezo? He doesn't have what to eat. Who's it talking about? So must be talking about, the only person it could be talking about, Lasuy Amai, Lav Lasuy Yishchar Pa'ula. We're talking about the cipher. The cipher is going to write it down. The cipher has nothing but to eat. So now Reuben trusts Shimon. What happens in the case Reuben trusts Shimon? They believe you. But there's an interest to write it down. Come Shalom, you can read that. There's a rule, is when it comes to business, there's no such thing as trust.
So why do we have
a mitzvah in the Gemara that says when you give, when you lend money, there's a mitzvah to write it down. You could do it, but there's the Chachamim say, we're telling you now, to avoid problems, write it down. Because you know what's going to happen? As time I lost 30 days, 30 days later, the guy's going to be convinced that he paid you back. He's going to be convinced that he borrowed it from somebody else. He's convinced that the loan fell through. He's not going to remember. Honest mistakes, loans create a big problem. Write it down. Now, comes Chalamoy, you don't want to write it down. So if you trust them, so the prohibition of Chalamoy overrides Takana Chacham to write down the whole law. So you trust them, you don't write it down. You don't trust them, you write it down. Now, what happens if he trusts him? So you wouldn't be writing it down. But he says to himself, ordinarily I'd write it down whether or not I trust him, but it's Chol HaMoed, so I won't trust, I'm not going to write it down because I trust him. But he, the cipher, needs to eat. So to make him feel good, give him an honest day's work, I'm going to hire him to write the shtar. He hires him to write the shtar. So he trusts. In the case where he trusts him, he's nevertheless going to relax the prohibition against writing. It must be the cipher. So we have a proof from here that you can hire a laborer and engage in malacha, writing is a malacha. The cipher is going to write it on Chol HaMoed because he needs what he needs.
You don't really need him. You
didn't really need him. You were just doing it as a
well.
In a sense, you really did need him because there's a takana chacham. You should write it down. It's not an absolute chiyuv, but there's a strong suggestion from the chacham to write it down, and it's almost like
not strong enough that they could give you a knas that you write.
I'm talking about on a regular halakha, you're supposed to write. Now, Chol HaMoed, you're not supposed to write down. You're not supposed to write on Chol HaMoed. So, case, where the person needs the money, he can to make Yom Tov, so then he can write the shtar. I'm sorry?
Did the Lovei approach him for the loan?
The Lovei came to the Malva on Chol HaMoed. And so now the Malva says, I trust you, but he needs to eat. Okay. So we'll make him feel good, and we'll say, I want to write it down. So maybe the Rav Sheir says,
can you have a goy write it down?
No.
Generally, asking a goy to do, and we already had the rule before, asking a goy to do something is the same as doing it yourself. You know, if you're not allowed to do it yourself, you're not allowed to ask the goy. If you're allowed to do it yourself, you're allowed to ask the goy. Maybe the Rav Sheir says, Rav Sheishet asked the question. Chachamim oimlim, the Chachamim say, Shalish umni is eisem malach barbet tzach. Here are three types of three types of craftsmen who are less engaged in their craft on Chol HaMoed. We're not saying on when. On Erev Pesach until Chassid. There were two types of minhagim about Erev Pesach. On Erev Pesach, some had the minhag, some places they had the minhag that they didn't do malachah the whole day Chol HaMoed.
the whole day, Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach, from the morning till the night, no melach. Then there were those who, they stopped by chatzos. Four chatzos after chatzos. Four chatzos is the melach after. And now we're talking about in the cities where they hang, and that custom, whatever custom you have, that's the custom, and it's binding. So if you're in a city where the custom is not to do melacha at all on Erev Pesach, so now, comes Erev Pesach, if you want to do melacha, you can't do it, even in the morning, except for these three, the chayit, the tailor, the sapper, the barber, and the chayit, and the laundry. The laundromat, the barber shop, the tailor shop, the cleaners, they can be open until Kaddish. A chayotin, why is a chayot permitted to be open Erev Pesach before Kaddish? You can't have your tefer kedakim chelish alif. Just even a cholamoy, a layperson, a non-professional, an amateur, can sew on cholamoy in the usual manner. We said only a professional seamstress can sew with the regular stitches, but have to be machlit, have to use these irregular stitches.
So therefore,
since even on Cholamoid, which is so much more strict, which is a halacha, not a minig,
yeah,
you can have an instance where an amateur can do it in the normal manner.
So on
Erev Pesach in the morning, will allow even the professional to engage in that because it's a lesser prohibition. The barber and the laundromat, because we find an instance where we're going to learn later that somebody who comes from overseas, somebody was on a ship, and there was a barber on the ship, and he comes, he rides on Kolomoy, he comes to the port. Now he's got long hair. He feels embarrassed. He's going to go to each soul on Yom Tov with his long hair, so he can take a haircut. Or somebody who was released from prison, he didn't have a haircut. He doesn't have clean clothes. He doesn't come smelly to shul. He doesn't come with long hair to shul. So in such a case, he couldn't do these activities before Yom Tov. So normally we say, if you waited until Chol HaMoed, then we're not going to allow you to take a haircut. We're not going to allow you to launder any clothes because you should have done it before Yom Tov. But this person had no choice. He didn't have an option. He was in jail. He was on a boat. He was nothing for him to do. But then, in those cases, he can do it on Chol HaMoed. And since he can do it on Chol HaMoed, under those circumstances, so we say that on Erev Pesach, which is only a minute, then we'll allow everyone. Anyway, this is somewhat odd, says the Gemara, because if that's the case, there's virtually no melacha that you can't do on Chol HaMoed under some set of circumstances.
Well,
like the Gemara doesn't speak about this, but there's a whole lot of things that you can do because of Dabar HaAvod, because it's going to be a loss of loss of principle. There's a lot of things that you're allowed to do because it's L'Tzerech HaMoed, because you need it for Yom Tov. There's a whole lot of things that do it. You know, so there's virtually going to be nothing that's going to be left over in that case. So why do we limit only the chayit, the safar, and the kayvus to engage in their trades before chasayis? We should allow everybody to engage in whatever business. You know, why shouldn't we allow all the stores to be open, everything, to engage in business as usual?
Okay.
Well, now we're going to ask it in with specific question.
Right.
But essentially, that's the way the Gemara is going to say. You talk about it, so Rosh Hashanah asks, I don't understand. We said that a laborer is allowed to engage in labor, and virtually any labor on Chol HaMoed, he has nothing but to eat. So now you can say that every toil could work on the Erev Pesach before Chatzos, because we find that Chol HaMoed, an instance where a laborer can do labor on Chol HaMoed.
When you restrict, but he has nothing to eat.
Right, that, but we said that if that, we're on Chol HaMoed, you can do it, albeit with a restriction,
sure.
And on Erev Pesach, you can do it without restriction, because it's only minig. There's halacha, and we relax even halacha, but then you can do it on Erev Pesach. Then it shows that it's not that strict of a type of a labor or whatever. But now we say that toil can do any labor, so now every laborer should be able to work Erev Pesach. So now you've just eaten up the entire roll. So in that case, we said if there's a rare instance. Well, listen, not every case. We didn't say every person can take a haircut on Chol HaMoed. We said only the person who got off a boat. So we said only in that rare instance it's permitted on Chol HaMoed. And yet we say now in Erev Pesach, he can do it. Everyone can do it. So now, Mashiach Rabbah says, and Rabbah asked from another vantage, we can say the same question. Now, let me ask that, Vini and Lishtiri, so let us be able to build, to do construction, start putting up houses in our face there. So, because we find, Shekane, turns to Lai Be'er, which is set up, and says, we said earlier that if a wall is leaning into a Rishus Arabim and it's creating a Sakhana, you can demolish the wall and rebuild it on Chalamayim. And now we can demolish it. It can actually rebuild the wall on Chalamayim, even though once you've demolished it, there's no Sakhana for the public, and we still say you can build a wall, so we should be able to do construction on our faith. So, Maskev LaRavina. Ravina asks for me at a third vantage. Only at the Lavlar. Let the Plaker be able to write on their face. She can't take the condition of Hashem Kitu Rishayim. For the Cholim Leib, you can write a star of engagement, or a star of divorce, or a receipt for a payment. All these things you can do on the Cholim Leib. Along with Rashi. So Rashi said, they really asked me a question about Chalamoid, about from Erev Pesach. Chalamoid, Mishum Tircho. The basis of Chalamoid is Tircho. The reason for the prohibition on Chalamoid is Tircho. The Makkav say the Shere Abonim. And generally, when there's a law, or we relax the prohibition of Tircho on Chalamoid. And this is where Tesis has asked the question of what about Tircho that has no Malacha? And wants to say from this Gemara, it was seen that even a tircha with animal loss, and that's why the Gemara was saying you're not allowed to bring food into the house on Cholamoid, not because of a malacha, but because simply because of tircha, even if it's a tircha with animal loss. But Arba Osar, but on the 14th day of Nisan, what's the reason why we say you're not allowed to engage in malacha? Not because it's Yamtev, because we should cherish Yamtev, because we want everybody to be occupied with preparing for Yamtev. We don't want people to be getting triggered. But Erev Pesach is a very, very intensive time for preparation for the Yamtev. It's more than the Shuas and more than Sukkot. It's a very intense preparation. So we want everybody to be free to do it. So that's why we're prohibiting. Needed the Tzerech Yamtev, things that are that are needed for Erev Yamtev. So these three people are needed for Erev Yamtev or the Yamtev. The Yamtev Shara Rabbana, for that they left. Because people need to take a haircut Erev Yamtev. They need to wash their clothes for Yom. People need all these things for Yom. But other trades, you don't need to have it for Yom. That's why they are allowed it until Chatzai. Need to allow the trade of Yom. The things that are not needed for Yom, the Lashon Rabbah come in permit. So now we have to go back and it just seems a bit odd, this answer, because what did we say? We said in the beginning, we said, what's the reason why you're allowed to engage in these three activities? On Erev Pesach before Chatzai, we said because we find that you can do it on Cholamoid. We didn't say because they needed to be for. That wasn't the reason that we said originally. So to reconcile these two things is that the point is that we allow on Erev Yomtiv you to engage in these things because we need it for Yomtiv. The reason why we're allowed to deviate from the minhag is because we find that even a Cholamoid would be allowed. But the main point of all of this is because you need it for Cholamoid. So it's not enough just to say you're allowed to do it on Cholamoid. There's a manner in which there's an instance, an occasion in which you can do this on Cholamoid, so you're allowed to do it on their face. No. First, you start with we need these three activities to be performed on their face before Chatzai. And we can create this leniency because it's only the whole prohibition is only a mimic, and we find even a Cholamoid instances where you'd be allowed to do it. And so therefore we can relax the mimic. But it's not enough to just say, oh, we find an instance that a Cholamoid you can engage in activity, and therefore we're going to relax the prohibition. One is not allowed to move objects from one house to another house. But he can move stuff to his chatzer. And the Gemara is going to explain what's going on over here. At first, the Gemara thinks that you're not allowed to move from one house to another house in the same chatzer, but you can move from one house from inside your house to your chatzer. But the Gemara is going to change that. That's not going to be the maskana of the Gemara.
Similarly, one valid, if somebody brought a keli to a repairman to repair before the Yom Tov, and now he wants to bring it home, he's not allowed to bring it home. And there's two different reasons given. One is because of the tircha, or other stated reason is because somebody who sees you taking out items from the repairman's house is going to suspect that you brought it to the repairman on Chol HaMoed. In Chodesh Lehem, however, if he's he's afraid that it's going to get stolen, he suspects something. The final chaser case, you can move it to another chaser. So we're talking about what happens if the repairman is not the most trustworthy person. So he pays the trust. He already paid the repairman. Now if he waits till after Yom Tov, the repairman's going to say he never paid me. Or the repairman's going to say he never gave it to me. Or the repairman is going to run away or whatever. So he doesn't fully trust this repairman. So he's allowed to move it to another chaser, to his friend who lives nearby, and put it in his house. Then we're going to learn tomorrow what happens if he has nobody nearby to bring it home. But out of the information, the Gemara says, we saw it in the beginning, in the final cloud, we're not going to move it at all. In the final bias, we're not going to move from one house to another. Now it seems like now we say that you can move it from the Oman's house to the chaser. Or from your house to your chaser. So why would you be allowed to do that? Amar Abaya, so he's saying, that what we're saying is, what the mission is saying is, you're not allowed to move objects from one house in a chaser to a house in another chaser. But while houses in the same chaser, within the same courtyard, you can move house, you have items in house A that you can move it to a house B that's in the same adjoining chaser. It's adjoined in the same chaser. You can't take it to another chaser, so a house in another chaser. That's too far. That you can't do much tircha. Too much tircha. Now this rule and it's put down in the machine, but the chrenim seem to suggest that's actually the halacha. If somebody is renting a house and he bought a house, he can hire the mover and can move his house at Chol HaMoed from his friend's fault to his house that would be huge setback. The simcha that he had of moving from a rent home to his own home is so great that it overrides the tercha of moving on Chol HaMoed. But one is he's not doing it to him. Chol HaMoed. He bought a house, and now he found a house, and it was a beautiful house. He sold it, he bought it on Chol HaMoed. Now he wants to move right in. That simcha is so great, he can move it. They end up being killing the base Oman. You're not going to bring your utensils from the Oman. Either he bought it there from them, or if he repaired it there. I'm going to pop a particle on Rava. Now, Rava said that Rava tried to test us. He gave us a test, and he asked us, he gave us a quiz. Now we learned in the Din Kalim Beis Oman. We learned in our mission, you're not allowed to bring Kalim from the Beis Oman. I'm going to ask you a question. We find elsewhere it says that you're allowed to bring Kalim from the Oman's house. So how do you reconcile this? Yeah, he knew the answer. You just asked him to say it. I hope he's able to say the Hamoyed. Even if they're not, let's say the Hamoyed, you're allowed to bring it. Now, so you don't come and tell me that the answer is because here it was Lutzer Chamayit. Because there it says, and that is just that not Lutzer Chamayit. V'shanin Allah lay, and he answered him, we gave him two answers. Kam ba'arba, also kam b'chelesh Chamayit. So this, where it says, a lot of people from the Beis HaOmah wasn't talking about Chalamayit. It was talking about Erev Pesach. Erev Pesach is no prohibition to bring Kaili from the Beis HaOmah. Kam b'chelesh Chamayit is, here's talking about Chalamayit. If you want, they said, we can give you a second answer. In both instances, is talking about Chol HaMoed. Why in the first case we say you're not allowed to bring it, in the second case it's here, you are allowed to bring it. How about we made a conversation? I mean, here's talking about where he believes, where he trusts him, and where he doesn't trust him. Where he doesn't trust him, he can bring it back.
Trust him is not allowed to.
If he trusts him, he's not allowed to bring it back. And if he doesn't trust him, he is allowed to. The Gemara says, Vatanya, so usually Vatanya is a question. Rashi tells us Vatanya here is Siyua. We wanted to bring as a proof to our position to Rava. that it says in the Brayer from Medina Kelim and Beis Ha'Oman, you're allowed to bring a kelim from a Oman. So you go to the Kadr and Beis Ha'Kadr, you can bring a jug from the potter's house, a case of Beis Ha'Kadr, and a glass from the one who makes glass, the glazers out. Avaloi feminine Beis Ha'Seva, you're not allowed to bring wool from the dyer's house. The loy came in the umma, the not other utensils from the house of the person who made it, the tradesman, the craftsman, the artisan, whatever it is. Why? In this case, different from the kelim in Beis Ha'Oman. Obviously, with the kelim in Beis Ha'Oman in the beginning that we said that you can bring a cup, a jug, or a glass, because those are going to be used on the Yom Tov. But other utensils that they're not going to be using on the Yom Tov, you know, I'll bring it back. They may be my Yeshel. What happens if he doesn't have what to eat? That means the artisan, the craftsman, if he doesn't have what to eat, so you can nice and scurry, so then he can give him his payment. But Menichah, he has to leave the item there. That's like, they may not know what happens if he doesn't trust him. And these are the Beis HaKadosh, so then he can bring it to the house that's next door to his friend's house, next door. In Chosh Shlaham Shemim, you can put it out from Chosh Shlaham Shemim, you can he's afraid that somebody's going to steal it. No one in that courtyard that he trusts, he can bring it to the next courtyard for someone he trusts. The Nehem Aminif, there's no one there who he trusts in the next courtyard. And then he gets into this place. If there's no place closer that he can leave it off, he can bring it quietly into this house that nobody should see and suspect that he hired these people on Halloween. The Gemara says, so the Rabbi says, Tarasta, your first answer was a good answer, but your second answer is not so good. Because Tarasta, you said, your terrorist, about that the second, that it's talking about, the first case is talking about where he trusts them, so he can't bring it home. And the second case is talking about where he doesn't trust them. So that answers, that's going to be it, that he's allowed to bring it home. But if you look at what I asked you, the price that I asked you, what it says, Nevi'in Umaylichin, you can take it home, and you can bring it there. Now, if you don't trust the guy, you shouldn't be bringing it there on Cholam Moed. So what does it mean, Umaylichin, that you can bring it there? So Kasha is a question. The Katahi Emevi'in, the Cholshkin is Emeylichin. So the Gemara said, Ela Mechavarta, so we retracted our second answer, and we were left with the first answer that we gave to Rava, Kedashim and Bikara. The first answer was that here is talking about where he doesn't have what to eat, and the second one is where he. I'm sorry. The first one. The first one was I've also in the call and. So the second answer is not a good answer. Mechafim is the kasha. You can cover over the figs that you. The dates that you have dates that you're leaving to dry. They're in the drying process.
Yeah.
And you suspect it's going to rain. Right. And there's too many to bring in. You can't bring in. You want to cover it up with a tarp, but they didn't have a tarp.
Yeah.
So you want to cover it over with straw. So cover it with the cash. You can cover it over with straw. Rabbi Yehuda says, I'm Avin. You can also be Ma'avin. You can make it thicker. We're going to explain what Ma'avin means, what the Gemara is going to have in Machalik is what Ma'avin and Ma'avin means exactly. You can make it thicker. Lishri Fayed is the covering. Moshe paid his ksus to the kelim. Those who sell food, clothing, utensils that are used on Cholam Moed, they're allowed to sell it quietly without big fanfare with Shem HaMoed for the purposes of the Yom Tov. Those who capture animals, fish, whatever, the sheishes, those who grind. They grind wheat. Thus, tour, ikdam the shushem shavan tour chadu v'shnayim v'shen in the mind. The Gemara is going to say exactly what it is. So basically, they grind wheat into, they separate wheat into two, three, or four pieces each grain of wheat. Like the very says, these are people who take beans and they right. grind it into a meal. Obviously, the tzina, they can do it with tzina. The tzina chamayit for those who need it for the bayit or for themselves for the tzina chamayit. Even though they're professionals, so if someone walks by and sees them engaging in this process, they're going to think that they're just doing engaging in labor for you know regular business as usual. So they can do it, but they have to make it in a quiet way. Says, they, in all these cases, they were machmir on themselves. And we're going to find out exactly what the chumrah was. Libi Barachir, Barabba, Rabati. Rafir Barabba and Rabati had an argument. But the right was the Chizkiya and Rabbi Yechon. And each one said it in the name of Chizkiya and Rabbi Yechon. Had Amr Mechapin Akushi, that Mechapin, that we said in the Mishnah, that the Tanakhan said that you can be Mechapin at Chizkiya, that you can cover over. So what does mechapin mean? Mechapin means a klushi that you can put a thin layer. And when Rabbi Yehuda said that ma'afma avim that you can put a thick layer means asuchi, to put a thick layer of straw on it. Because in the terka, the time comes and comes with a thin layer. And Rabbi Yehuda says, no, it's not that much of a body, you can put it in a thick layer. Or because of the loss, you can put it in a thick layer. Chazam and Mechapin, the other one says, what does the Tanakhama mean when he says Mechapin? He says you can make it thin or thick. You can make it as thick as you want. That's not what Mechapin. Not what Ma'avin. Ma'avin, what the Tanakhama doesn't allow, and what Rabbi Yehuda does allow, is Ma'avin is Oizah Kivin Kri. Means to take and pile up all of the dates into a pyramid. You're making it into a big heap, and then you're going to cover over the pile with straw. So first of all, the bottom ones are going to be more protected. Second of all, you can use less straw, but that takes a lot of labor to make it into these big heaps. So Rabbi Yehuda says, no, you're totally allowed to do that, and the Tanakhama says, no, you can just put as much straw as you want. But so we have two opinions on what happened and what Abin means. And what's the machlokes of Tanakhama or Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah? So now we're going to say, Tanina Mihachi, we're going to learn that a proof to Rabbi Yehuda. To the one who said that Ma'abim means that you can make a tree. Tanina Mihachi, Ma'abim is going to say that you can make a tree. That Ma'abim, that he said, and the Rabbi said that you can make a large heap. And then pile over the pile with straw.
Means that tree is what?
The meaning that ma'avi means a tree, a pile, a heap. So we see that the one who said that it means a bottom with a heap is correct. And the Tanakhama allows both thin and thick layers. What you prohibit is making a heap before putting on the layer. Give your review, these are the words of review. Anyway, basically, say this is just a kind of making the thinness. Those who sell clothing, kelim, the utensils for young, the measure of the they can mature kambahir. You boil them, they ask in the base medish. Hainich Nirin al Asman, when we say that Rav Yehi said that all these people were machmer on themselves, so what was it that they were machmer? Is he saying, now, there's two ways of understanding this Mishnah. We can understand the Mishnah by saying that what Rabbi Yezi was saying is that it's only a Chumrah, and the Tanakhama is saying it's a absolute Isser to sell the Far Hasia. So the Tanakhama says you have to sell the Tzina. And he's saying you must sell it the Tzina, and that's from a Halakha perspective. You must sell it the Tzina. You must do it unobtrusively as possible. And Rabbi Yezi is saying, no, you can. You really can sell it with fanfare. You can have someone standing outside, oh boy, come purchase money, you can do whatever you want. And it's only a minute that they were machmer on themselves not to do it for fanfare. Or we can understand this Mishnah as saying that the Tanakhama says that you're allowed to do it with Tzina, and Rabbi Yehuda is saying that these people were machmer on themselves and they didn't do it at all. Even between us. So how are we to understand what Rav Yehi is saying? Is that they wouldn't do it at all? I don't know. Or we say that Rav Yehi is saying that it's not a halacha, it's just a meaning that they didn't do it that with our answer. So let's come to try to resolve it. from this right. We say that those who sell fruits, clothing, or utensils have to sell it on electricity. Rabbi Yehuda says, Tangri Tveria, that the sellers in Tveria, they were mashmar and social way, that they didn't sell it at all. So we see that Rabbi Yehuda is saying is that there were Tangri who were mashmar and not to sell it at all. So you're kind of counting the halacha, and Rabbi Yehuda is saying that they were even more machmir than the halacha, they didn't sell it at all. So you must sell it to do it to Tzina, according to the Tanakhama, and Rabbi Yehuda says, even the Tzina, there were those that didn't want to do it. By the way, there's a Yerushalmi that says that Abaye was a curse to people who did this, saying because people needed to buy stuff beyond them for the last days, and they weren't able to buy. And so he didn't like this practice of being machmir. To be machmir for yourself, only machmir for the other people. The other people need to prepare for Yom Tov. And if you don't open your store, they can't prepare for Yom Tov. Don't be thrown on somebody else's cash. So, the same thing, those that would hunt chayes eifes and talkim, they would do a spetimu tzerchamayim. They were machmir that they didn't engage in this process at all. So in charity, they were those that were machmir on selling, and in akku, they were machmir not to engage in hunting or fishing. Now, those that crossed Hikla, Targus, and Tisina, they can crush in an unobtrusive manner with Seder Kamai. So these are people who are professionals, and they want to do it for themselves. So if they would do it publicly, people would suspect that they're engaging in their trade on Kolomoid. An ordinary person, an amateur or a lay person, somebody who has some other business in this, something that he's just doing for his own necessity, he knew it in the ordinary manner. The casual observer is not going to think that he's doing it for sale. They'll say, no, he engages in that. But the person who does engage in that as a business, he can only do for himself, the sin unobtrusively. That the Vesheshis, see, pray they were machmir on themselves. Shalom Yudoshim Kolikid. They didn't do it at all for themselves. They were professionals. They wouldn't even do it for sin, and they were machmir. Amar Abaya says, Chilka, what is Chilka? You just said that Chilka is crushing. So Chilka, what's Chilka? Chilka is Chodul Tarkus. You take the grain and you divide it in two. Tarkus is Chodul Tlas, where they take the grain and they divide each grain into three. Tisne chagol arba. They divide into four. I guess they were more and more fine types of cereal that they would make from it. I'm not sure. Yosef Shabini, when Rabini came, he said, you know what chilka is chilka, it's felt. So that's dividing it all. When we talk about chilka, we're not talking about dividing it in two. We're talking about felt. Chilka is felt. Those that crush felt. The Gemara asks, how could he possibly say that chilka is chilka, that it's felt? Nesvei, you learn chilka, targus, and tisni, it's made with all markets. Chilka, targus, and tisni are tummy in every place, or universally tummy. So I understand why it would always be considered tummy, no matter where in the village or in the city, it's always considered tummy, because those that divide it into two or three into four, Mishun Hachim's name, Bechal Makim, this kasha, because in order to crush it that way in two, three, or four, you have to first soak it. Now to explain what's going on. Nothing becomes tummy unless it first became wet. It can't have fruits, vegetables, produce, anything that has never become, never has come in contact with water intentionally. Come in contact with water. The person had intent for it. Yes, if it was unintentionally, it's not mukhshalik habit tamei. And there may be times where it's not intentional, but consider it intentional. But the point is, if it came in contact with water, it becomes mukhshalik habit tamei. Now, normally when they sold grain to the villagers were not so particular with the purity of the grain of the wheat. That should be so fine that it didn't look. They're not dealing with it. In the cities, there were fine schmeckers, they didn't allow that. So they wanted everything fine, pure. So grain that's sold in the city is always considered common. Is always considered common because we know that it was soaked before they got rid of all the impurities. The villagers were not considered common because they didn't generally soak it. So unless you knew that it got wet, it wasn't considered common. Now, when you have these things that are divided, the 2, 3, and 4, the only way to do it is to first soak it, so then it becomes easier to divide. So that's why, whether it's in a village or it's in a city, the only way to engage in this process is by soaking it. So we know that if you want to buy these types of things, chilta, assuming chilta is divisioning by two, or targets, or tisni, we know it was soaked, so it's much of a kabbalah, whether it's in a village or in a city. Even though regular grain is not, if it's in a village, it's not much of a kabbalah. Hello, Laman Dama Klumta, but if you're going to say according to the one that says Klumta, spelled, why should it be considered tummy in a village? Just like any other grain would be considered tummy in a village, why specifically spelt should be considered tummy in a village? It's not mukhshir like any other thing. But the Gemara says, no, we're talking about, you know, kind of kunta, we're talking about according to the kalpun, we're talking about peeled kunta, peeled spelt grain. You love the shadow of the mayav, but you have a mikleta, because if you wouldn't have soaked it, you wouldn't be able to peel it. So it must be that it was peeled, so no matter where you purchase it, if it's peeled, you know that it was soaked. So the Gemara asks, when I carle chilka, why should spelt be called chilka? The shakil chilki is chilkeo, because when you peel it, the remaining grain becomes very smooth. But that's why spelt is also known as chilka. Naysway, now I'm going to ask another question on the opinion that it's spelt, and we're going to try to prove that chilka means that you divide it in two. And this is in that dog, if somebody says, I swear I'm not going to eat crops, I'm not going to eat dog, I'm not going to eat grain. Also, after full image, she's also not allowed to eat. Not only is not allowed to eat the kosh, meaning dog on the five types of grains that are described in the Torah, he's also not allowed to eat dry Egyptian beans. But if they're still fresh, he can eat it. Because when they're dry, they used to grind it up into a flour and they would make bread. So even though normally we say that dagon is only chamesh from the Torah, it's only the five types of grain, but when it comes to the Nedarim, we go by what the people say. People call this type of Egyptian dried beans that are ground into flour, they call it a grain. So they piled up into piles and whatever. They call it grain. So this is referred to by the populace as grain, and the measure goes by what the populace considers it, and since the populace considers it the grain, they used to warn up these grains, you know, to eat not only the five grains, but also the full image. But he's allowed to eat oiris. Oiris is generally translated as rice. The Alter Rebbe leaves it as a suffix, whether it's rice or millet, and that's why you're supposed to eat it. The chasud, it could be a shahak, it could be a adam, it could be a zaynis, depending on, so therefore, it depends, as iris is a zaynis. But if iris is millet, then rice is a adam. So then it leaves the topic, and maybe it should be a shahak, so best to just leave it for a meal. But anyway, assuming iris is right, we'll call it, for our purposes, we'll call it rice. What about iris? The person who's swears they're not going to eat, killed the is not going to eat the dagon, is allowed to eat oiris. But what the oiris, the chilka, the targets, and tisni. He's allowed to eat chilka, targets, and tisni. He's allowed to eat these divided grains in 2, 3, and 4. So now, finish laying on the mandam, the tata, the last one, the larva. So now it makes sense according to the one that says that targets, that chilka is the one that he divided it up into. That's why, sometimes they're not going to pay stuff, because when you divided these grains into 2, 3, and 4, they didn't eat it, they didn't then crush it into flour. Then what would be the point of dividing it into 2, 3, and 4? They would eat it that way as divided 2, 3, and 4. So they didn't make it into a bread. So it never was considered a dagon, a type of that was going to be turned into flour. So therefore, when the person says, I'm not going to eat this, he didn't mean those foods. He meant bread flours, or, you know, grains that you're going to turn into, actually, as you're going to turn into flour and turn into bread. It's a denaka lama in the first dagon. Lama lama klunta, but according to the one that says that chilka is spelled, Dagan Ha'oyehu. Shvelt is one of the Chamishas Mimit Dagan. So what does it mean that he's allowed to eat it? Of course he's not allowed to eat it. Where's the Kasha Sakakasha? So therefore, we conclude that in fact what is Chilka Chilka means divided into two, and it doesn't mean, as the other person said, Punta, that it means God. Rav Kana allows Profisa's Mechrit to summon, brings Rashi's big machlekes, what it means, but some others who agree with Rashi, it means those who sell spices are allowed to sell spice in the normal manner. It means they don't have to go to Tzina, they don't have to do it unobtrusively. Because everyone knows that they're doing it for the government. The Mechrit was written for a Chayyab. So the Gemara asks, Eisvei, how could you say that they're allowed to do it
for summon?
No, the summon means spices, not for smelling. They can use spices for the food.
For the food.
The spice for food. Now, what we're talking about here is spices that are fully ground spices. We're not going to like Rashi, because spices have very strong question on Rashi. But we're talking about, Rashi says it's talking about crow, cabbages, they're not spices. Bottom line, the simple explanation is, what we're talking about is we're talking about normal spices that are, once they're ground, as soon as you grind spices, like people who grind coffee will tell you, the moment you grind it, it starts to lose its potency. In those days, they wanted very potent spices. They buy very small amounts of spice. They grind it. Once it's ground, it's got to be used right away, otherwise losing its potency as you thought. So they would buy a very small amount. Since they were buying minute amounts, it was only for Cholam Moed. And everybody knew that people who are buying spices are not buying it past the yom, they're buying it for Cholam Moed. People who bought fruits by contract, well, you buy green bananas, it's going to take a week for it to get ripe. Or you buy other fruits that aren't fully ripe, it's going to take time. Or some people buy fruits and not necessarily the yom, they buy it for the next week. But spice is always purchased for the amount of quantities, and so we say that therefore you can sell it as obtrusively as you want. You don't have to be honest. Answer Rav Kana. Rav Kana asked the question on this conclusion that we said that the spice sellers can sell it in any manner that they wish. So we say Chanus Pshutim Ustok, we say Chanus Kedarki, that a store that opened only in the side streets, they would have the main thoroughfare in the old days, the way they had it with the marketplace, the main thoroughfare, then there were these side streets. And the side streets, they would have benches. But people who needed to sit down and rest for a while. At the end of the side, this little side street, this little alleyway would be another shop. You'd have thoroughfare, little alleyways with benches, and at the end, there would be a little, vendor at the end. So those vendors weren't really obtrusive. They were somewhat unobtrusive to begin with. So they could just leave the store open the way they usually do. So they can leave the stores open the way they want. So those that are on the main thoroughfare, normally the way they had the store set up was they had two doors. They had pull-down gate or a closing gate, but it would close half the store, and then there was another one to close the other half of the store. So sometimes, like when it came lunchtime, they didn't want to fully close the shop, but they didn't want to eat in the public either, so they closed one gate, so they had some privacy, but the store was open. So the same thing, so you leave one open to show that it's Chalamayit, you're not, it's not business as usual, and they were only selling what Tzerei Chalamayit. But the last day, Hashanah Rabbah, just before Shmini Atzeret, Shachar Moitzi Ma'aser Shukia Ir B'Peris. Then they would have the vendors have tables set up all over with fruit because of the special holiday of Shmini Atzeret. It's special because it's the Chag of Shmini Atzeret, special Yom Tov, and the Shvil called it Yom Tov Acher. So we say only because of this that it's a covet of the Yom Tov Asher, they call it Yom Tov Loi. So the Gemara answers, Loi Kasha, some question. How about Pedro, how about Tavlin? And they're talking about for fruits, like fruits on Shmini Atzeret, you could sell as public a manner as you want. But again, with Tavlin, you can always sell in a public manner.
Well, you've got a lot more time consuming than a lot of the other injections.
Also, worth showing this book because it's relevant to a lot of the beyond that most people don't learn and don't know and they're not very particular about.
You do it very well.
I can't come every day.
No, listen, I don't need to.